This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to another triple header with Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with three interviews and three great guests. I'll call Tasmania to learn why it burned and why climate-driven fires threaten all of us. Our guest is world-recognized fire expert David Bowman. Then we'll investigate why the Obama administration is rushing to sell off oil and gas rights on the dangerous outer continental shelf of the Gulf of Mexico and in Alaska in the Arctic. Is that fire sale meant to fatten a Ponzi scheme of big oil stock prices? Economist John Talberth explains why he's suing the government. But first this. I'll bet you know who Paul Ehrlich is, but just in case, he's a professor of population studies at Stanford University and president of Stanford Center for Conservation Biology. Maybe you know him for the world-famous book co-authored with wife Anne, the classic The Population Bomb. Since then, Paul, with Anne and other authors, have published dozens of books. In February 2011, we interviewed Paul for his latest Humanity on a Tightrope, written with Robert Ornstein. Now Paul and Anne ask a rather extreme question, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, no less. Can a collapse of civilization be avoided? Dr. Paul Ehrlich, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be here.
But I have to wonder, after a lifetime of weathering criticism, why did you put out this provocative paper? Why now?
For instance, we just finished a presidential election in which no serious issue was ever debated. In the United States, we're seeing all this stuff about fiscal cliffs and debt limits and so on. All these things are trivia that are easily settled by negotiation among human beings. For example, nobody ever mentions that for every nickel of debt, there's somewhere a nickel of credit, that you could rearrange things that would involve some transfers of wealth. But nonetheless, people could solve that with paper and pencil, or at least with computers. What people don't seem to understand is you can't negotiate with nature. You can't say, well, we've raised the temperature by almost a degree Celsius, but we're going to break through 2 degrees. Nature, you've got to let us continue our agriculture even if we go up to 5 degrees. And the scientific community is worried sick. And, of course, we are faced with a dramatic program of disinformation funded, in this case, largely by the fossil fuel industry, which is trying to confuse people about how serious just one aspect of our environmental peril, that is climate disruption, is.
Well, I wonder, can a whole globalist civilization really go down? And what do you mean by collapse?
Well, collapse is there's a huge debate about exactly what constitutes a collapse. The classic Mayans had huge cities and temples and writing and scientists and so on, and now their descendants are basically small-time farmers, and they don't have anything we would consider civilization like Western civilization. But basically, you can think of it as losing the things that people listening to this program value, that at the very most, people would be struggling most of the time just to get enough food and shelter to keep going. And that's the kind of collapse that globalization faces with. After all, many, many civilizations have collapsed in the past. A few have recovered. The Egyptians are a good example because their agriculture was, until we built the Aswan Dam, refreshed annually by the floods of the Nile. But most civilizations that have collapsed have not come back.
And you mentioned climate change, and we've talked about population. You've talked about population, but I counted 9 other developing ecological problems in your paper. Could you talk about a couple of those?
Sure. One of them is the spread of toxic chemicals from pole to pole, which people have been aware of, scientists have been aware of for some time, but they haven't been aware until recently of the importance of endocrine-disrupting compounds, which are compounds like bisphenol A, you may have heard of, which have dramatic effects when they're in tiny quantities, and it can also poison you in large quantities, but the response is different whether you're exposed to a little bit or a lot. And we're seeing all kinds of nasty symptoms in animals traceable to these compounds. And there are frightening suggestions of things happening to the human population. For example, in some subarctic town, a lot of these chemicals tend to concentrate in the polar regions. And in some subarctic towns, they've recorded twice as many girl babies as boy babies. And that's a bad sign because the normal ratio is about 105 boys to 100 girls. So when you're shifting the sex ratio like that, that's showing something in the environment is having a dramatic effect on development, and that's not the sort of thing you want to see. So toxic compounds, the global toxification, is particularly serious because if it really gets away from us, if it starts, say, giving everybody cancer of the pancreas by the time they're 10 years old, we won't have any clue what to do about it. There won't be any nutcase solutions like we have for climate change. So that's one problem. Another problem is the growing danger of vast epidemics. A huge problem written up in Michael Clare's new brilliant book, The Race for What's Left, is that we're going to more and more dangerous to get at and poorer resources, and we're likely to fight wars over them. We're already fighting wars over oil. We have fought a war. The Israelis and Syrians fought a war over water. Recent studies show that even a small nuclear war, say between India and Pakistan over agricultural water, would destroy our civilization. So there are a lot of problems out there, and some of the most basic ones, like the loss of biodiversity, the destruction of populations and species of the other organisms we're utterly dependent on, going on continuously and basically unnoticed. So it's not a pretty picture. The pretty part of the picture is if we really wanted to do something about it, we could. The two basic drivers are population growth and continued economic growth among the rich, overconsumption. Overpopulation and overconsumption are the two main drivers of the situation. And historically, since about 1880, population growth has accounted for somewhat more of the damage than increased consumption, but both of them are in there, and you can't really separate them. Trying to separate, say, which one is more responsible is like trying to say, is the length or the width of a rectangle more responsible for its area? So, yes, population is a major issue, and you may have noticed it's never discussed in the United States. In fact, there was a recent news release saying it was too bad that in California, the net reproductive rate, that is, the family size, has dropped below 2. Well, that's extremely cheery news, but of course, idiot economists think it's bad. Yes, population, a central issue. As a matter of fact, the main criticisms we've had of our paper in the Journal of the Royal Society is it's too optimistic, particularly on the population front.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and Stanford biologist Paul R. Ehrlich. Paul, there is a disaster porn industry these days, but you published in a journal known for science. Is there science behind the possibility of civilization collapsing?
Oh, not only is there science behind it, we refer to about 160 articles, which is just a small sample. And of course, the article was reviewed by dozens of people, including a Nobel laureate in economics and so on. In other words, this is not the view of a couple of eco-freaks. This is the standard view of the scientific part of the scientific community that looks at these things. The biggest argument I have with somebody on the topic, with a scientist on that paper, is with Jim Brown, who's a member of the National Academy and the world's most distinguished biogeographer. And I have told him that I think the chances of civilization surviving are about 10%, but that I'm willing to work hard to change it to 11% because I care a lot about my child and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. And he says, "Paul, you're crazy. I think the chances are only about 1%, but of course I'm willing to work to try and make it 1.1%. So while the Rush Limbaughs of the world don't even know what's happening, the scientific community is discussing how likely we are to be able to avoid the disaster that we're storming towards.
Well, yes, you told Stephen Lee of the Independent Press Service, we are all scared, and I don't see this fear in the TV shows or the mainstream media. So who is it that is scared?
Well, it's the scientific community, the environmental scientists, and particularly the climate scientists, because the most obvious change that we're watching now is the appearance of rapid climate change earlier than we expected. When we wrote the population bomb, Ralph Cicerone and others hadn't discovered the other parts of the heating forcing. That is, we just thought CO2 was the problem and not things like nitrous oxide and methane and so on. And now we're beginning to see the effects. So for instance, Australia is cooking right now with record temperatures, going to wreck their agriculture if they're not lucky, and so on right now. And this is just a small taste of what's going to come in the future. Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, just a small taste of what will become common in the future. The top climate scientist in the U.S. government, Jim Hansen, has actually gone to jail protesting coal plants. That's how seriously scared he is for his kids. The climate science community is desperately worried, but of course there is a well-paid prostitution ring, intellectual prostitutes paid by the fossil fuel industry to create confusion about it. If you don't believe it, there's a wonderful historian named Naomi Oreskes, who with a colleague wrote a book called Merchants of Doubt a couple of years ago, which goes into detail about how the Fox News Network and others are paid not to even mention climate disruption when we're now entering into a serious bout of it. Even today, the climate in the U.S. has changed dramatically. We have a cold spell in California and a warm spell in New York. The whole climate system is changing, and our food supply is utterly dependent on the climate system, to say nothing about our shorelines faced with inevitable sea level rise.
Well, in your paper for the Royal Society, you do offer some solutions. But just before we go there, Paul Ehrlich, do you have a sense of timing for this? If you had to set your future plans, like when to move out of town or something, when do you see a collapse being possible?
I think it could happen any time if we have either a resource war that turns nuclear, or we're setting ourselves up for vast plagues. So that could happen any time. But in terms of more gradual things, I would say that it's becoming obvious to people in places like Australia right now, and I would say that in the next decade or so, it will become dramatically obvious to everyone. And the food situation, remember, the food situation's already bad for a lot of people on the planet. Almost a billion people are hungry. There are food riots now because food prices are increasing. All that's likely to get worse. It's likely to get worse unevenly, but I think anybody who's really conscious of what's going on in the world can see it happening right now, and it's happening to a lot of people, but not people listening to this program.
Well, your paper suggests a couple of things that could be done to improve our food supply. Can you give us a snapshot of that?
Well, the first thing I would do is give women completely the same rights as men, opportunities, job opportunities, education, and every sexually active human being access to contraception, modern contraception, and backup abortion. Because if we don't move towards a gradual decline in the human population, there's no way we can support it, because, of course, each person you add to the planet adds disproportionately to the chances of collapse in our environmental problems. So that's the first thing to handle, because it's going to take a long time to move towards population shrinkage, whereas we can change our consumption patterns overnight. We should be working right now to get rid of fossil fuels. We shouldn't be fighting wars in Central Asia to get oil flowing towards our country. And about 40% of our military budget is designed solely to bring oil to the United States and our allies. And that's like if we were hungry, spending 40% of our military budget to bring cyanide to us to eat, because burning fossil fuels is a really bad idea, and we should be reducing it as rapidly as possible to half or less of what we burn now. So those are two places to start. Thinking about how we can share the wealth of the earth with the people who are living in misery, 3 or 4 billion people living in relative misery today, would be a good idea. In other words, instead of arguing about how many people we might possibly support in the future, why don't we learn to take good care of the people we have already?
Well, some of this leads to an inconvenient question. I interviewed Dr. Timothy Garrett from the University of Utah. 2 years ago, he published a scientific peer-reviewed paper showing only a complete collapse of our fossil-based civilization right now could avoid crushing climate change, and we're creating this deadly mass extinction event. Maybe we should help this suicidal system collapse instead of trying to save it. What do you think?
Well, I think just from a personal point of view, and because of the friends and my children and grandchildren and so on, we ought to try and keep the lives of the people we have now in the best possible shape as long as we can, while we work very hard to see that in the near future the world has fewer people and living less heavily consumptive lives, and paying much more attention to how they deal with, treat their environment, and how they treat each other, because we don't do a very good job of treating each other either. So, but that's a personal ethical decision. You got to remember, when people say save the Earth, the planet isn't any danger at all. It'll be circling the sun for a very long time, I suspect, after Homo sapiens has disappeared. What we're caring about is the ability of the planet to give decent lives to people. And if we want a maximum number of people to live decent lives ever, we have to have a much smaller population for a long time.
What is foresight intelligence, and how could that help us?
Well, this is foresight is intelligence as a form of intelligence that the MAHB, the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, MAHB.stanford.edu, is pushing. And the idea is we have proven that simply telling people what the science says does not get the behavior changes that are necessary. That is, the situation with the climate has been worked out in great detail. 98% of climate scientists agree with it, and yet no action is being taken. You don't even hear it discussed. And so, what is the U.S. doing about climate change? The answer is, as a federal government, close to nothing. And that's something that has to be changed, and that means developing foresight intelligence. That is the intelligence in humanity not just to look towards the future, but to change our behavior in response to what we see coming in the future. And we actually have an Institute for Foresight Intelligence here at Stanford now. But how to get it done? That's a question all of us have to be involved in.
You know, I told a friend I was going to talk with you about your new paper, and she was a bit impatient. She wanted to know, well, what's the answer? Can we save global civilization or not? What do you say?
Well, the answer is yes, we can. But the big question is, will we? In other words, I'm very optimistic that if we went on to a crash basis like we did in 1941 after Pearl Harbor, that we could do the job. There will be difficulties and there will be premature deaths and so on, but we can save civilization, but only if we get into a crash program now. You can't wait another 10 or 20 years to see what happens and then suddenly try and revise our entire energy situation, reduce the size of our population, completely change our water handling infrastructure, which is something we have to do because the climate is precipitation patterns are changing continuously over the next 1,000 years. All those things should be started right now, and we don't have the leadership or the knowledge to do it, and we've got to force that somehow. I'm sorry to be depressing, but I know you want the truth.
I do. That's why we called you up. And I wonder if there's something that I've missed or something else that you would really like to leave with our listeners.
Well, this isn't something you can depend on governments to take care of. I urge you to go to mahb.stanford.edu. Even if you're just a concerned person, and get involved, put your ideas in there. Everybody ought to be talking about how the hell do we get out of this miserable situation and give our kids and grandkids a decent life, and learn about it. You can get the paper online from the Royal Society perspective section and read it and read the literature in it. Learn about it. None of the science is all that complicated. Many of the principles are extremely simple. So don't feel that you're helpless. Get involved. Get a movement going. Lean on your politicians. We all have to get together. We're social animals. We got to get together to solve the problem.
You've just heard Dr. Paul Ehrlich, co-author of The Population Bomb and much more. He's an esteemed professor of population studies and conservation biology at Stanford University. His latest paper, co-authored with wife Anne, is Can a Collapse of Global Civilization Be Avoided? Paul, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Good luck to everybody and Happy New Year.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. The image of kids in the water clinging to a dock under a fire-red sky captured the situation. The Great Australian Heat Wave of 2013 also struck the southernmost part of the country, the island of Tasmania. Maybe this is the future anywhere trees grow, we wonder, as global warming heats the planet. Professor David Bauman is at the University of Tasmania in Hobart. He teaches and researches forest ecology. He's a published expert on fire in the Earth system. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you going?
Well, it's going pretty well here. It's wet here as opposed to what you're having. And I wanted to ask you before we get to the science, is that kind of 40-degree heat and fire normal to Tasmania?
No. That day I was actually out in the wilderness and I was telling my buddies that something absolutely catastrophic was happening. all of the switches were on for a fire catastrophe. And what was spooky for me, because I was uncontactable, is that I didn't learn about the fire disasters around Hobart until I got out 10 days later. We were safe, but the fact that the environment was tinder dry, the winds were very, very strong, the heat was excessive, so excessive, in fact, that around Hobart, some of the more sensitive plants have actually died off.
Just from the heat, not burning?
From the heat, not the drought.
My, my. So what is your impression of the public reaction? Are people worried by this? Has it raised the talk about possible climate change?
Yeah, well, there's two answers. I felt a moral dilemma because I knew this was going to happen. So a year ago, I wrote an article saying, I know a fire disaster will happen. I don't know when. I am certain that it's related to climate change, but I can't necessarily prove that. And that actually made me personally feel very good. And of course, it was passed unnoticed. A year later, it happened. Then the issue becomes politicized because the different political teams want to put different accents or emphases on this tragic event. And as a scientist, it's very important to give a tragic event a wide berth. It's not the time, to my way of thinking, you know, trying to argue the toss about whether it is or isn't, that particular event is or isn't climate change. But that's why I felt pleased that I was able to say it in a very neutral way a year ago when nobody was taking any notice. The awareness of fire in Australia has shot through the roof. And I think for thinking people, they're beginning to join the dots. They're looking at the landscapes that they're living in and realizing that some of the landscapes are way more vulnerable to a catastrophe than the fire that occurred, for instance, at Dunalley, where that extraordinary image of the family sheltering from a fire, it literally was a firestorm. It was something outside the bounds of normality for fire behavior. It hit fast and hard. It would have killed many people were it not for the fact that it was on a little peninsula, which has had a channel cut through it, and so everybody was able to take refuge into the water. Now, the weird thing about the Dunalley fire is that that's not a bushland setting. It's just a rural, it's got eucalypts and it's got bushland around it, but it's not the iconic bush settlement. It's not what you would think of as being highly vulnerable to a catastrophic bushfire. I've taken journalists who visited Tasmania to places that I say, you want to see where a catastrophic bushfire is going to occur. I take them to them and they get it very quickly, you know, dead end valleys, heavily settled, covered with eucalypts, you know, one spark and the whole damn thing's just going to kill everybody.
Well, and it's happened before in Australia. Back in 2009, 173 did die. But here's something that's puzzling me. Australia, I thought, just got some relief from that long-standing drought with a couple of wet seasons. How did such extreme fire conditions come up so quickly?
Yeah, well, that's actually interesting. A discovery that fire ecologists around the world have actually made is that, and again, I applied this logic and popularized it in the media. The discovery is that what's called antecedent rainfall, if you get two or three wet years, in the popular imagination, that's good for fire. But in a fire ecologist thinking, that's bad, because what you're doing is you're growing a superabundance of fuel. Really, it's the departure from those wet periods, what the climatic departure looks like. Is it abrupt and going into very dry, or does it sort of gradually tail off? Are there enough animals to eat all of the fuel? Are you able to use fire to reduce the fuel, and so on? And what happened here is that we had this enormous quantity of growth after a very, very long drought, and then we got, as I said, a couple of these very hot days which hayed off the grass and basically converted all of the fuel in the landscape, which was reasonably moist because there hadn't been a drought, to tinder. It's a terrible combination to have very wet periods, lush growth, followed by very extreme heat waves.
And are forest fires in Australia increasing generally, or is that just our impression due to media coverage?
A very good question, and a very difficult question to answer. The reason it's difficult to answer is because we don't have high-quality records. And in fact, this problem is a global problem. Now, In environments like tropical savanna environments, where fire occurs pretty well every other year or every year, using satellite imagery, you can build a very good appreciation of fire activity, and you can identify an anomalous year which has got a lot of fire activity or little. But in forest environments, which may take 30 to 100 years to regenerate and produce fuels for these high-intensity fires, maybe even 300 years, it's extremely difficult to go back 300 years because 300 years ago we didn't have satellites. And so we have to use historical reconstructions, and historical reconstructions are very fraught because they require quite intensive, complex technique. They're difficult to generalise. They've got lots of constraints. You know, they don't work in some settings.
Well, have scientists estimated what will happen with global forests if we do go beyond the 2-degree safe point, or well beyond, perhaps?
The answer is a yes and no answer. Just using common sense logic, you know, fires increase when you get higher temperatures and dryness. And obviously, if you throw in the mix, more humans messing around with ignitions. And possibly, climate can increase the number of what are called dry lightning storms, the lightning storms that don't extinguish the starts. And there's concern that all of those things are happening. And they say, well, let's project into the future. Well, how will we project into the future? We'll have to use models. One of the real problems for the climate models is that they're really interested in the central tendency, as it's called, the averages, the sort of the mean values. What fire is about is the absolute outlying events. They're the game-changing things. It's, you know, imagine trying to predict in 100 years the number of days where the fire danger is going to be catastrophic. I mean, you know, no scientist can do that. We can approximate and estimate and use lots of ingenious go-arounds, but we can't give a reliable indication. So we use common sense and we say global warming is going to result in more fire. But there's a very big catch and a very worrying catch. And the very big worrying catch is that if we get all of these fires and we start emitting all of this stored solid carbon and turn it into gaseous carbon in the smoke, we may actually be putting an accelerant into the Earth system. That's a worry.
Right. That would be a positive feedback loop.
A positive feedback. And that's why we are worried. And once you see the general view of climate modelers is, well, fire just isn't such a big deal. It's a second or third order issue. Why would you be worrying yourself to death about building fire activity into an Earth system model? I can assure you that many clever modelers are now turning their minds to trying to represent fire in the Earth system in models. But as soon as they do that, they discover something quite horrible about fire. Fire is not like temperature. Fire is not like cyclones. Why? Because fire has three components. It has a geophysical component, which is like a cyclone, but it has a biological component. Fire is begot from life. The plants are the fuel, but the sorts of plants influence the fire behavior. If humans, say, mess around with vegetation, they can actually change the risk of fire. If they introduce flammable plants, they can, like eucalyptus, as they've done in California, they can increase the intensity and the severity of the fires. They can actually change ecosystems. But most critically, fire has a human dimension. We have forgotten something. We are fire animals. We're the only animal on Earth that uses fire routinely. We use it all the time. In fact, global climate change is because of our fire habit.
Radio EcoShock will be right back in just a minute with forest ecologist and fire expert David Bowman, straight from Hobart, Tasmania.